That's Footprints by the wonderful Wayne Shorter, who was born on this day in 1933. Of course, that was the Herbie Hancock. Remember the great Wayne Shorter on this day, his birthday. So we are about to enter into the world of local politics. On the way there, local news. Remind you that Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com. Their banner is at steinershow.org. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. We're going to take a look at local issues and politics here for the next hour with our guest remaining with us is Dr. John Bullock, professor of political science at Tosh University and a new co-host here on the Mark Steiner Show, as well as substitute hosting for the show. Always good to have him in the studio.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
Zoe Carpenter is in the studio. No, that's the wrong date. She's always gone. Dr. Natasha Pratt Harris is in the studio, though, associate professor and criminal justice program coordinator in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology here at Morgan State University and a member of the Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee for Baltimore City. Good to see you again, Natasha Pratt Harris, always.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Melody Simmons is with us, independent journalist for 35 years of experience in journalism, as an investigative reporter, writes for the Baltimore Brew and other journals. Good to have you in the studio.
Great to be here. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here. You know, I was thinking about I was looking at this piece about the casinos and the money being diverted and how communities are going to around the casino are going to get money and how that money is being spent. I immediately thought about the series of murders and shootings that have taken place in Baltimore and its environs over the last week. Two teenagers were killed in the last week. A man was beaten and set on fire to be burned to death in the street. Another body was found shot in the My man was shot multiple times in the weeds. Other murders have taken place over the last couple of days, at least last night from what I read in the morning's some papers. And I think the question, I guess, as we deal with all these things around us and the way we spend money and don't spend money, what's our response to this? In the wake of everything else going around us, this gets lost.
I think it shows we have two cities. This is a tale of two cities. It's very clear. We're living it. We're seeing it every day. And there seems to be a disconnect between City Hall and the streets. Again, there's a lack of transparency. There's a lack of dialogue. And this is where Baltimore is kind of at a crisis point now, needs to have discussions about very critical issues.
Yeah, I think that we definitely have a problem, but the good news is we have some active persons in City Hall who are engaged with the community, folks like Council Member Brandon Scott, who's kind of taken a look at, you know, crime just around the corner from Morgan State University, murders that have taken place just recently. So, I think we have a lot to do, but it's just a tragedy to have to kind of deal with this on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. You know, I agree that there are also some actors, along with, Brandy, the Manir Bihar, 300 men movement, but also, people like the Mosby's been doing marches. But at the same time, it's unfortunate that a lot of the resources that are coming to the city are not necessarily used or not necessarily effective in terms of dealing with these issues. Because these are larger, deep social issues, right? We're talking about neighborhoods. We're talking about family structure. We're talking about opportunities for education and employment that aren't there. And so we see this is really a symptom of something that's larger and deeper. And it does speak to the divide within the city in terms of the haves and the have-nots and the lack of opportunity structure.
So can there be a response to this? I'm curious what our listeners think at 410-319-8888, what the response can be, both on the community level and on a city government level. I mean, what is it we're not doing to respond to this, other than, I know, the people who commit these heinous crimes need to be separated from us and put in prison. Nobody disagrees with that. I think most people don't disagree with that. But the question is, how do we intervene on this? What is it we can do to ameliorate this, to lessen it, to make it not such a daily fact of life for so many communities in the city? Not every community in the city, but so many poor working class communities in the city.
I think just not being desensitized, because you hear it every day, you live it every day. If I've personally experienced it, you know, over time you kind of almost become, people can come, become immune to it. But I think if we just continue to be angry and saddened and understanding that life has been lost and these are precious lives that have been lost,
right.
We will kind of continue to stay the course to address these issues in a an effective way, in a way that's strategic, similar to some of the work that the 300 Men March fellows have been engaged in.
And I also think that there needs to be more grassroots involvement in addressing some of these issues, bringing some of the issues to light up to City Hall, having debate, having hearings, whatever needs to be done. The churches need to step up a little bit more and be more aggressive in the communities, reaching out to people and families, mostly young people, who really feel lost, who are out there without opportunities, without good education, and they need somebody to bring them together.
Mm. Right. It is that everything all at once piece, right? And we're talking about the government. We're talking about grassroots. Again, you know, recreation opportunities. And we look at the, you know, the lack there, lack of those, but also employment opportunities. And so how do we, you know, partner, you know, I'm saying, whether it be with unions, whether it be with educational providers, with community associations, dealing with some of the issues that we talk about in terms of, you know, vacancy and blight in our neighborhoods, but then also, drug abuse and the like. So we're talking about public health. We're talking about mental health. We're talking about intervention in terms of families. All those things are important, and oftentimes the resource base is so small to be able to deal with that. We're just taking a piece here and a piece there and not getting at some of those solutions. And also, it's getting at it before it becomes the issue, right? So many young people, once they have contact with the criminal justice system and now they're unable to have employment, now they get involved into a deeper life of crime, or whether they're not able to provide for their families, the community suffer. And so, again, all these things are connected to one another.
So, I mean, part of the question is also kind of building strong community in the city. And we have a difficult time kind of figuring out how that, what the city can do to do that, or what cities should do to step up to the plate in terms of having, whether it's putting people to work, rehabilitating neighborhoods, not just neighborhoods of wealth, but rehabilitating neighborhoods where a total dislocation, and rec centers and whatever else has to take place to change the nature of communities. I mean, that so that if something like these things happen, that there's a community response.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, and that there isn't. I mean, and I think that is part of what, Natasha, where the city government lacks. There's no kind of creative new thinking about how we deal with this. I mean, how we relate to our communities. I was thinking about the curfew that's being put into effect. Now, the mayor and I had a conversation about this on the air, and one of the things I said was, you know, instead of giving that to the police, suppose you took your $500,000, $600,000, and you put it into safe streets, or hiring trained counselors or social workers who would be in the streets to see little kids in the street, go to them, where's your mom, where's your dad, where do you live, and have a conversation with the family in some proactive stuff that doesn't criminalize every little act people make, as a way to maybe helping to end the criminal acts that do take place.
Exactly. And currently, right, I mean, it's a fact. I've actually made personal observations when it comes to the curfew law and implementing it slowly but surely. You've actually had young people who have been criminalized being told to, you know, leave the harbor at a certain time, and just this expectation or this assumption that they're doing something wrong, as opposed to them just hanging out and having a good time. But in fact, going into the pockets in those particular neighborhoods where there are problems, and actually engaging in conversation and building community, or continuing to build community in order to kind of address these holistic issues. So I definitely agree.
I think also the families need to be involved too. I think that that's where there's another disconnect, is between the system and some of these curfew laws. But where are the families involved too? That is an essential piece of the puzzle that has to be put into place for the dialogue, for success to happen, because these young people will be parents one day too. And so the example they learn from the leadership of their parents, their home, any kind of welding that can go on there, is going to help them down the road with their own generation and their own children.
Exactly. And we talk about community. I mean, that's not something that's static. That's something that's built over time, and it continues to happen. And so we, all of us have to get out of our house, have to get out of our comfort zones, and talking with those we may not be used to talking to, and talking to our elected officials. Also, voting as well, right? All these things that, you know, that have an impact on our daily lives that we don't oftentimes think about. holding our elected officials accountable, not just, you know, for the election, but then after the election? What about the things we asked you about? What about the funding for the for these resources? But then, like we all were saying, basically, all of us have to not be as dispassionate, but also desensitized from these things, right? And say, well, this is the way of life. But then to really, you know, show our outreach. And again, that's crossing age, racial, and economic boundaries to do so.
So, folks, what do you think? 410-319-8888. We want to hear your ideas on this. These are our communities. These are our friends and relatives. These are family members who are dying or being or terrified of what happens to them every day of the week when they walk out of their homes. What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. And, you know, when you look at how we respond to things, right now let's take this casino that's opening up. Two things about this casino that's opening up in Baltimore, and I'm curious what people think about this casino opening and how it feeds into all of this, because as casinos are surrounded by a lot of very poor neighborhoods, mm-hmm. the casino is, on the west side, and some of this money is supposed to go to those communities. But then, A, we have to define what does that mean? How is that money going to be spent for what in those communities? And I think that has to be raised. And then, you know, I saw a picture in the paper. This is totally anecdotal. I have no idea of the reality, but I want to walk into the casino myself to see for myself and find out from the people who are organizing the unions to see what the reality is. But when I saw the pictures of the people dealing the cards, being trained and all around the table, I didn't see a black face in the picture. Natasha, you saw that too.
I just made an observation this past week when I drove right through that corridor. Yep.
Not one.
Not represented.
So are we saying that maybe I'm wrong about this? Maybe there are African Americans who have been hired for the highest paying jobs in that casino working on the floor, but I haven't seen it. Mm-hmm. And are we saying that you couldn't find 150 African Americans in this town who can be card dealers, who can run a blackjack table? I mean, mm-hmm. that struck me.
That was a big push from City Hall at the time when the casino was opening for the Mayor's Office of Employment Development to get out in the community, recruit for the jobs. They did have a 10-mile radius catchment area, which, of course, includes part of the county, part of Arundel County, 10-mile radius outside of where the casino is located. So they were very, very aggressive, they claimed, about going out and finding city residents for these jobs. This is an accountability issue. It's a question that needs to be asked. Show us the data.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I would like to see the data on it because, again, the picture doesn't speak 1,000 words.
And maybe all the black folks they hired were on the fringes of this that thing and not in the picture. I don't know. But
Or in training.
And then also, what's the
it's
rationale?
Possible.
Right? I mean, will you hear that, okay, well, it's an educational issue in terms of people being able to meet certain testing skills, but then also we're talking about background or drug tests or anything like that. So oftentimes those are some of the reasons that we get, but also it'd be interesting to see if the data actually bears that out.
I mean, I don't know.
And hopefully it looks different than what we think it is.
And if you
we'll
know,
see.
Did you apply? Did you try to get a job? 410-319-8888. What is happening with this casino money? We know that some of it that the mayor said is going to be diverted to fix a steam pipe.
$3 million.
Right.
Right. Now, that steam, I just learned from reading the articles that Veolia that we talked about last week, 2 weeks ago in this program last week, the transportation company that was a that was trying to figure out what is in the contract they're trying to sign with the city now to manage certain parts of our water system, to consult on it, and what that has meant around the country.
Very politically connected.
But they manage the steam pipes, we just learned, and they don't want to spend their money to fix them. Mm-hmm. So what do we know about this?
I've been reading the Brew like everybody else, and also the Post, and hearing some information. But here's what's interesting. I mean, you know from those funds that you can use. And I say can use some of the funds for infrastructure. Doesn't mean you must use those funds. And when we talk about holding our elected officials accountable, it's important to recognize that they can also facilitate certain deals. So whether that is saying, well, you'll pay this up front or you'll pay it later to take it out of their fee for running the circulator or something like that, as opposed to saying, look, I know Senator Ferguson has talked about this, that, look, if we do fight this, then it'll hold up things and there'll be a long litigation and things like that. But I think it's also important to make a stand in some of these cases so that we're not giving so much away either to developers, to private corporations who are doing business in our city and who are actually making money doing business
making
in our city.
Making millions.
Yes.
Well, also, the question is, why doesn't the city have $3 million to fix a pipe?
What does the city have money for? I mean, the question is where the money should come from, but who should be doing it?
Yeah, where the money should come from, and why should the money, why should they rob Peter to pay Paul in that instance? This was not a debate that was put forward. It was put forward as an emergency, got to do it, you know, right at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. And you have, I mean, Veolia has a history of maintenance issues that were in a document that we'll have on our website from citizens.org of not maintaining the pipes that they're in charge of running. And then charging, having the cities pick up the tab for fixing the pipes, there are some issues here to be raised. I think things move too quickly sometimes. What do our guests think? I mean, what do our listeners think? At 410-319-8888, Melvin, Windsor Mills, you're on the air.
Yes, I was calling to respond regarding the jobs for the casino. One part of it is a moral issue. A lot of people, I mean, I'm no saint, but I don't think that lotteries are good for the economy, for the society. The second part is that for those upper-level jobs, they were requiring hair samples. Mm-hmm. And for the kitchen, I think they were here to do a drug test for that. Mm-hmm. So that part right there probably eliminated a lot of African-Americans being in those jobs. The other thing I wanted to say was that I made a comment regarding what your show to someone regarding Ferguson, uh-huh. And I was saying basically the economic abandonment. When I said that to that person, they said, nobody owes me nothing. So I think as long as we continue to tell each other that we don't owe each other anything, that we will consistently cut each other off, because everything that we do is based on communal effort. Insurance that we have, car insurance, mortgages, all of that is based on people participating, because none of us can afford to just buy those things outright. So as long as we continue to think that we don't owe each other anything, nobody owes me and I don't owe anybody anything, we'll continue to have the same effect. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, once the data is available, it'll be great to kind of assess the demographics of those who are working at the casinos, but I am confident that we have a nice pool of folks of color who are qualified to work in the casinos. One of the discussions at our prisons is, you know, the demographics of the correctional staff, and we have a nice number of folks in the prisons who are of color who are working as correctional employees who have also gotten a hair sample. So I'd like to see again the demographics of those at the casinos.
So would I. Mm-hmm. So that's something we'll look at and push for with our friends in the media to see what's going on. Talk to people we know who are organizing workers at the casino, what they know. And I just would like to take a walk down there myself and kind of walk through and visually see what I see in the casino. I'm not a big guy on gambling, but I just want to see for myself. Mm-hmm. Stay away from those one-arm bandits. 410-319-8888. Chucky B., you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
First time caller. I just want to drop a little knowledge on you about that casino.
Okay, go ahead.
From my personal opinion, I have worked in the casinos in Atlantic City. I have like 15 years experience working in the casino. I've worked in the front of the house, which is where the gaming tables and the slot machines are, and I've worked in the back of the house repairing the kitchen equipment. One thing I can say to you about gambling is that the people who have put all this in motion, just like in Atlantic City and just like other places, they really have no regard for the community at large. The same game that they playing in Maryland, they played in AC, you know, talking about they're going to hire, 10% of the community. Well, you know, a lot of brothers and sisters back then, they had criminal records, so that automatically removed them, even though they said, oh, well, we tried to hire them, but they couldn't pass the criminal background check. Well, they knew that from the very beginning. That was a game that they laid down, you know what I'm saying? And as far as the gaming industry is concerned in Baltimore, it's amazing to me that, they've got, for example, all these slot machines and all this stuff going on. And that was my specialty in Atlantic City. I was a slot machine technician. I have not seen any advertisement, none whatsoever, for slot machine technicians. Slot machine training, have not seen any of that. You know, this so-called gaming commission. I mean, who are these people and what knowledge do they have? I would venture to say offhand that there's probably not too many people in that gaming industry here in Baltimore and Maryland, period, that has as much knowledge as I have about the gaming industry. So where are these training programs are for these people? And I'll just listen to your comment and take it off the air.
And Chuck, I appreciate the commentary. 410-319-8880. What do we think about what Chuck E.B. just said? I mean, I think that's...
I think it's an excellent point. I mean, honestly, we start talking about, you know, the technicians and the training, and then those are jobs that are sustainable because those jobs don't necessarily come and go. You need those types of jobs, whether it be in a casino or anyplace
right.
else. But I think, you know, to the point that was made earlier in terms of why the city doesn't have the money to pay for these things, we look at the structural imbalance or look at, you know, the fact that the city has a limited tax base, and so that all of these things like gambling are looked at as a savior in terms of the tax base. And I'm glad that Atlantic City has come up because Atlantic City is a great example of that. If you could look at the you know, city legalizing gambling and 78 and it's supposed to be economic advancement, but you look at economic abandonment, you know, all throughout Atlantic City outside the casino areas, and I think there's a great parallel you can make in Baltimore to Pimlico. You live by Park Heights, your
right.
old stomping grounds. You look at the neighborhoods surrounding that. All the race impact funds that were supposed to be going to the community, and some would say they do, but you don't really see much visual evidence of it. So the community at large tends to not you know, get what their fair due, if you will.
Right, and some of those impact funds include employment development, mm-hmm. include job training, include reaching out to the community, to community centers, to churches, looking for candidates for employment. And that is what lifts a community ultimately. We haven't really seen it.
And as far as I'm remembering, mm-hmm. the money was supposed to go back to schools. So I haven't heard any specifics about that and the
right.
you know, push to make sure that happens. That's what we were called to vote for in 2012. So
you know, it raises the two issues you all have raised and what our caller Chuck E.B. just raised. You know, I don't know the answers. I would like to know. I mean, if you have X number of casinos in Maryland, what is it, five now? Is that what you're supposed to have, right?
Five or six
casinos, and at least three of them within reach of metropolitan Baltimore fairly easily. And if you had to have, who knows what the number would be? I'm going to put a number out there: 50 to 100 people to maintain the machines and maintain those casinos. Mm-hmm. How many of those jobs and training for those things went to people in Baltimore City? Went to African Americans in Baltimore City who, for the jobs that pay a great deal of money, to do the kind of work Chuck E.B. was talking about. I mean, I'd like to know the answer to those. Are they importing everybody from New Jersey to come down and fix these machines? Are these machines being fixed by people who are going to live here in Baltimore and be able to raise a family and earn $25 to $50 an hour to do the work to maintain those machines? I mean, that is, to me, these were the critical questions. And the other critical question is when we talk about money going to communities, when you look at what Westport is saying, there are several wealthy communities around that casino, and there's a lot of poor communities around that casino. They need different things. And most of that money should be going to those poor communities, not to the wealthy communities in Federal Hill, it would seem to me. And when they say community impact money, who gets to decide?
Mm-hmm.
Who's
well,
making the decision about where there's money and how the money's going to be used and for what?
Mm-hmm.
And who gets it? Who controls it? I mean, those are these questions that you know, we keep hearing these great terms, mm-hmm. like in Park Heights, but who actually controls that money?
And again, for
me, decisions.
Yeah, and you're making a great point. You know, these are great sound bites. You know, we're hearing these great sound bites. We're hearing that this is where the money's going to go. And then even for me, I don't necessarily hear any discussion about, okay, now this is how much will go to the schools. This is where we're going to kind of help to fund books and desks and, you know, things that we need in our public schools. So I'm still waiting.
We're going to take a short break and come right back. Lisa's called in. We're going to talk about some other issues and continue this conversation. And going out, you hear that? Little Eva. Song was released in this day in 1962. Locomotion. All right. What happened to leaving my locomotion? And we come back with something. come back with something called Cars by Gary Nolman. All right, that's what it is. Released on this day in 1979. Not something I listen to, but that's fine. We listen to it today anyway. So joining me here at 410-319-8888 as we look at the issues affecting our community here with our three guests, Dr. John Bullock, Dr. Natasha Pratt Harris, and Melody Simmons, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow at gmail.com. Talk at steinershow.org. We changed the address. Talk at steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Lisa in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Lisa. Because I would like to address one of the conversations about the casino.
Sure.
I have a cousin that actually was hired to work on the floor as a roulette operator.
Great.
And, yeah, that was great. And I believe that, you know, when we as a people stop pointing the finger at everyone else about why they're not letting us have jobs or why they're doing this or why they're doing that, when we start working within ourselves, then we can demand some type of answers and demand some type of respect. Like, if you can't get that job because you have a criminal background, well, as youngsters, we have to decide that we don't want that. It's been told to us by our grandparents. I know by my grandparents, if you decide that you want to go out and smoke marijuana and do drugs, there's consequences to that. If you decide that you want a criminal background check, there's consequences to that. And so, unfortunately, we don't have those older people investing in us anymore. And the younger people, I'm 40, so it's our turn now to start talking to our youngsters about what the outcome is going to be. We can't necessarily tell everyone what to do, but we can give them the information so they can decide what they want to do with it. Like your radio station, you should be on 92Q or 95, something where the young people can hear. But the only way people are going to hear this is if they're interested. And unfortunately, a lot of us are not interested.
Lisa, thanks so much for the call. Natasha, what were you thinking during this phone call? What's your response?
I agree. You know, we can't put the blame on others if we and ourselves can make decisions to make certain that we have a fair chance. However, you know, one of my areas of expertise and research is looking at those who have been wrongfully convicted. And I actually have some numbers that say that while some folks have these records, they shouldn't have them in the first place. So that's a whole nother discussion. I can go on for days about that. We don't have enough time to discuss.
You're always welcome to go on for days on the show about that. Anytime you like, Natasha.
Exactly. So, again, you know, that's true. Some folks have some issues with their record and some have gotten them cleared because of resources and opportunities to have the right representation so that they won't have that to be a problem when they actually apply for these jobs. But, you know, that's another issue all within itself.
I also think as a reporter, you know, it's incumbent upon us as news reporters and bloggers to get in there, ask the tough questions, don't settle for mushy data, pin it down, do what you have to do to try to get these answers. It's not easy. And the ranks are thinner, but these are important questions, issues facing our community.
Let me open the phone to you once again at 410-319-8888 and let Daniel and John, the next two callers, up. No, we're going to get your calls in just a minute. I'm going to throw another topic out here, but please call them about the casinos or anything else that's on your mind. Veolia, the steam, 410-319-8888, the overflow of sewage because we can't contain it, and 12.5 million gallons went into the Inner Harbor. That happened over this last big storm, and of course, many neighborhoods were flooded with. People don't realize this is not just sewage water they're flooded with. They're flooded with human fecal matter and more that came out of
the raw,
untreated sewage in the streets of Baltimore. So 410-319-8888. But the other issue I want to bring up before we get to Daniel and John was that Delegate Frank Conaway has been introducing this legislation year after year and has done it again, is going to do it again this year. He was on Anthony McCarthy's show, or they talked about it on Anthony's show the other day, and it was really kind of very powerfully interesting, is legislation to require police officers to wear cameras on their bodies that shoots everything that goes on in front of them. What are our thoughts about that?
You know,
it has not passed, but maybe this year it has some momentum because of what's been going on.
You know, it's possible maybe more momentum. I think it's also important to have some co-sponsors as well that may help to push that legislation. But on the face of it, cameras on the police is not a problem. Now, if you look at some of the reaction, though, from police, I mean, not just nationally but locally as well, we've seen instances where police officers have tried to, you know, shield people away have sometimes been less than polite, with our citizenry who are trying to record them. So that's interested to know what the opposition may be. And then also, I'd be curious to see what the response is going to be from the police unions. Are they going to be supportive of this? Because some officers will say, hey, if they're you know, officers above board, say, hey, this protects me in just in case something happens, as opposed to saying, well, I don't want people to see exactly what I'm doing, even though it's the right of a citizen to observe what's happening from our police.
Yeah, and we've always had that. We've always had persons who have been vigilant and observing what happens with police officers. Now we have it tracked in an official manner, where the police will have to be wear the device. One of the things that we even talk about as it relates to Ferguson is this kind of reality that we don't necessarily have any numbers on unjustifiable behavior for amongst the police officers. So if in fact something is questionable and later on it could be found to be unjustifiable, the baggage or the backing will actually come from the recording device.
Also, there's a lot of questions, who will receive the tape? Who will edit it? Who will present it? How long will it live? What's the shelf life? We live in a society where there's a lot of CC, closed camera, videotaping going on right now. I mean, you can't really cross the street without being videotaped. So there is a lot existing. I think the debate right now is really healthy, and it's time for it.
And we also now see the Baltimore City Police announcing that they have a drone, are going to buy a drone to watch the city.
Okay. I mean, that's surprising, but when you hear drones, you think about overseas. You think about military engagement, and we talked about militarization before. And again, this might not be exactly the same thing, but it's sort of akin to some of the things that we're talking about. But you're right; the expectation of even privacy is very minimal these days.
Minimal.
I mean, there's a growing part of our city police department is becoming its own department, which is the overseeing, just watching the citizens via camera, now drone
constantly.
Mm-hmm. I think if they want to do that, police officers should have to wear these cameras. Mm-hmm. And I think that in some ways may ameliorate some of the violence that takes place from police to citizens, and also protect police officers who are doing a good job.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious what our listeners think of 410-319-8888. As I said, Delegate Conaway has been trying to introduce this bill every year. Nobody pays attention to it. Take that back. People don't pay enough attention to it. It's never passed. But maybe this is the year, given the Ferguson and everything else going on, that it may pass. What are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. And let's go to Daniel. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good morning, Daniel.
I want to start off by saying I like listening to your station. And I like the points that you're touching on.
Thank you.
But one thing that really touched me was the fact that the Ferguson thing, that's a big thing. But as far as the casino thing and the finances that's coming from the casino, and the neighborhoods and communities that it's supposed to go to and who it's supposed to benefit. And as far as our educational system, and I also want your views on this too, and I just listened to it. What exactly is the financing going to do for our educational system? And then what is our educational system going to do for our African-American brothers? Because I heard you talking about as far as education and all of this, and it's like, none of these jobs that I've ever applied for, none of the jobs that I've ever had, I've learned anything about in school. You feel me? So it's like, what benefit am I really getting out of this educational system? Like, is it, should it be revised, or should something change about it? And I just really wanted to hear everybody else's points and views about it.
Dang, that's a great, great, great question and commentary. Do you want to say something, Tasha, first?
We're talking to at least two academics, and we're going to support and applaud educational opportunity and as long as it's fair and equitable and we're all getting the same resources. But for me, I have concerns about the slots and whether or not they're going to truly support public schools in the city of Baltimore, public schools in the state of Maryland. I recall the Maryland State Lottery. The reason we had the lotto, we were going to actually support public education.
Right.
And people have been disappointed. I've been disappointed. And I'm waiting and wondering if that's really going to happen with the gambling opportunity.
Legitimate question and needs follow up.
And I think, listen to what our caller Daniel was saying. Let me throw this out, too. I mean, we've talked about this a lot. Daniel was saying something really important. One of the things Daniel said was that all the jobs he's had, well, I don't know what those jobs are. I should have asked him the jobs he's had. that were not relevant to any of the education he had before. He wasn't trained for anything to get these jobs. So you can look at that in a number of ways. But one of the things that I think that we've had this argument on the show just recently, and it was pretty vociferous, because there's this whole push that everybody should be going to college and getting a four-year degree. Well, everybody doesn't need to get a four-year degree to make a living in this world. Mm-hmm. And we forget that. And I think that you can be highly educated and an artist and artistic and a really beautiful, lovely human being and fix slot machines mm-hmm. and make $60,000 a year and take care of your family, mm-hmm. right? We don't train our kids for these things in school. They're not, you know, the auto mechanics being taught maybe, you know, is now about computers. It's about understanding the digitization of our engines and how to fix those. That's not the same thing as when you could change the oil and fix the carburetor and tear apart an engine. You don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. Are we training young people for jobs they can walk into, plumbers, electricians, all the other kind of complex things that people need in this new digital world? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he's alluding to.
That is the major question. And to some degree, we are. There are some places you think about, you know, Carver, you know, stands out to me, and there are others that do it.
Carver here in Baltimore
yeah,
City.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Carver Vocational Technical. And I think, you know, we start looking at education, and it speaks back to, the tale of two cities, right? I mean, if you look at what's happening in terms of opportunity in our city, a lot of it, the opportunity in terms of jobs are around education, medicine, technology. And so if you're not, if you don't have the career training for that, you're sort of locked out. But you make an excellent point around, you know, I have friends who are electricians and carpenters and plumbers, and they're not going out of style. I can't fix my car, but they can. You know, I think it's important, you know, to recognize those trades are important, and having that having the connection not only between the trades but also between employers. If we're able to now partner large employers in Baltimore City with our high schools, with our technical schools, then we do have a path toward employment. And talking about those options, but quite honestly, we're preparing students for the jobs of 30 and 40 years ago, as opposed to what they could be doing now in the future. Also, green jobs as well. Those are other things that we can do. That fits right in with the trade of carpentry, but then looking at environment. You mentioned the sewage and all that. It can tie into our economy and into our environment as we move forward in the future.
And the reality is less than a third of Americans even have a college degree.
Right.
So, you know, what I actually advocate for is those who pursue higher education to kind of make the best of it. You know, and so much is getting and experiencing everything possible to be successful with the job. What I experience is that students don't necessarily recall. There's a recall issue possibly mm-hmm. happening, and they don't necessarily know that this particular skill that was taught in the classroom is applicable to what happens on the job. They're not necessarily making that connection. It's our job as educators to consistently remind them of how they can use a particular skill taught in the classroom at a job opportunity. So. Mm-hmm.
And I think as I'm a mother of an 18-year-old and a young adult, so I can tell you that it's very difficult for my kids to be able to take their educational experiences or what they're taught in the classroom and try to figure out what they might do in the world with it. So this is a problem where the classroom and the structure and the curriculum really needs to come together with the world as we see it today, which is changing rapidly, to help these kids.
410-319-8888, your thoughts on all these topics we've been bringing up here today. Really want to hear your thoughts on these things. I may go back to the casino funds in just a minute, but let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. John in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Thanks for having me on. I can't help but listen to your last caller, I think the caller before last, the comment that she had made about, well, perhaps we are self-inflicting some kind of consequences because the lifestyle is why they're doing it. Well, I mean, I just want to say that that's complete hogwash, because if you study carefully the history behind the criminalization of marijuana, you have to understand it's a racially motivated and biased law, okay, targeted primarily at African Americans. You, how can you justify in a society artificially manufactured substances like coke and crack that's tiered below marijuana as far as the effects? So, I mean, all I'm saying is, I mean, people need to get off of this issue of, self-guilt about it's what they're doing. It's got nothing to do with that. The system is just stacked against minorities. And the sooner people realize that, the better it is. And we should be thankful for president and administration like Obama and the Attorney General Holder that are beginning to see through this politics. It's complete nonsense, okay, to try and criminalize people for possession of joint and smoking marijuana, that's already medically proven. A lot of medical people indicate it's no worse than alcohol. I mean, this is not to say we're advocating that, but to then hold people back from gainful employment and productive life because of this, it's complete nonsense. I'll give you another example. Recently, I don't know if you followed the news very well. You got the situation with Baltimore CFO who was discovered for having a bogus diploma mill certificate. Do you know that there are several that I'm aware of in state government that went and bought diploma from diploma mill? Personnel people were notified of this. Nothing happened of it. They're still making money. In fact, they turn around and give them upgrades and pay grades, and then silently have these people retire either through disability or go off on a higher pay grade that they've unjustly gotten. But yet, if it's a black man, it'll be spread all over the news. So it's nonsense. It's complete nonsense. People need to wake up and understand what's going on.
John, thank you so much. I think that he raises that, Natasha. You were nodding your head yes as he was speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in Maryland, we're experiencing this change. As of October the 1st, we have this decriminalization of marijuana based upon a number of ounces that a person may actually possess. We want to be really careful when we even talk about that issue. One thing that people will assume, and we're going to try to change the DMC folks are working together. The disproportionate minority contact folks are working together to kind of make sure there's a public announcement about this, what's happening. That if a young person actually has possession of marijuana and they are stopped by the police, they can still be cited for engaging in what's called a status offense, which means that they can be at least questioned by the police and then made to kind of partake in some type of a diversion program, but they must partake. And the concern that we have is that young people of color will more likely have to kind of go through this process. And if families and the like aren't made aware of the possibility of it turning into a criminal issue because it didn't follow suit with this new process, that can be a problem. So we want to be clear, and that's going to be coming down the pike really soon.
And I think all the stats are there very clearly that white and African-American populations in the city, in the state, in the United States of America use marijuana at the same percentage. Now that and so black folks in America are 13% of the population of the United States of America at this moment, yet over 80% of the convictions and people serving time in prison are African American for marijuana. I mean, so there are that part of the inequality is really pervasive. And I think these are things you need to change bit by bit, just like how you raise the issue of who gets hired at the casino is connected to that to me, because you're also raising consciousness, pushing legislators to address that reality so that people are trained and hired. It's the same thing as pushing the reality of what happens with marijuana and who goes to jail. Cecil County Garrett County, let's say, has a very small number of African Americans living in it. Yet the overwhelming number of arrests for marijuana use are the few black folks who live in the mountains of Garrett County.
Right.
I mean, say no more.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Ben, you're on the air. Hi, Ben, you're on the air. Welcome.
410-319-8888.
I know you got it. Just turn down the radio, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi, Ben. Hi, how are you? Good. I just wanted to make a comment regarding the casinos.
Sure.
Personally, I've been there a couple of times, and I live here in Baltimore. And what I'm seeing is, you know, the casino pretty much preys on anybody that it can find. The weak, the poor, the rich. And one thing I've realized is, for me, better to leave the casino with a loss than a win. Especially for somebody that lives in Baltimore, where there's a lot of poor people here, there's a lot of people that are trying to make it, and a casino comes in there, and you know, the rule that the house wins always stands. And I feel that the casino is pretty much coming into the city to clean up shop. And they're going to clean up, and they're going to leave. The same thing that they did in Atlantic City, they come in, they siphon everything they can possibly can, and then leave. So what I have to suggest to people who are listening to the show and who go to the casinos, if you lose, leave with that feeling of the loss and don't go back.
Interesting. That's an interesting piece of advice.
You know, one thing.
Very interesting piece of advice.
It is. I mean, the house does always. But look, I'm not a gambler. I don't really plan to go to the casino. But I think there are some of us who actually supported having the casino in the city only for the fact of they didn't want the people from Baltimore going to other casinos around the region to gamble and use that money. And so it is that, you know, that tough case. And some people look at it as a moral issue in terms of who gambles and who what neighborhoods are and what people are targeted for it. I mean, I'm seeing in disadvantaged communities, if you will, seeing some of the billboards that are up there around gambling and potential addiction and things like that and how to deal with it. But again, it's still a very, very sticky situation in terms of who uses it and then what are the benefits of it. But I know from the city's perspective, hey, they want to get in on the game too rather than having everybody going to, you know, Charlestown or someplace else to go and gamble.
Well, also consider Maryland Live is about 10 miles right. down the road, maybe right. less. So mm-hmm, you've exactly. got two casinos. They're going to be competing within a very short distance of each other. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what those figures work out, you know, down the road towards Christmas and into 2015, just to see what kind of traffic they're having with players and gamers.
Right, right. I'm sorry, you say something, Tasha? 410-319-8888 is the number here. Let me go back to a topic we talked about a moment ago. And I was, again, when I was reading the bill that Frank Conaway wants to put in, it's a pretty pervasive bill. I mean, he talks about these videos have to be saved for 30 days or at the very least. They have to be in the control of people other than just the police department to be able to monitor them and see what's going on with them. I think, you know, we should enter this debate here in the show a lot about what this bill could do. And I think that it's a bill that people have to wrestle with, and they should really think about it. I mean, the thing is, to me, there's a juxtaposition between the drones on the one hand, right. the city wants to fly over, mm-hmm. and constantly watching us and being able to ensure that that police behavior is held in check by the cameras that they have to wear. And most police, I think... Well, we'll see. I'll be curious to see what the police think. We're looking forward to having a roundtable of police officers talking about this stuff and former officers on this program. Would be an interesting kind of way to wrestle with some of these things, too. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. Dave, you're on the air.
Mark, thank you very much for this show. I guess my question is just who is benefiting from these casinos and who is benefiting by employing drones in our city? I just think of when I came back from Vietnam, just hearing the helicopters buzzing over the city, and yes, maybe they get rapid surveillance a thing. On the other hand, what more benefit would be provided by a bicycle policeman and the money saved from using helicopters? So anyway, thanks very much.
That's a really important point.
And I'm glad it came up. You know, I was actually at a mayor's cabinet in the community for the 9th District last week, and one of the things that came up, people were talking about, you know, neighborhoods that see pervasive violence, and talking about what about the impact of having police on foot patrolling neighborhoods, talking about community policing. And so, you know, there is something to be said about having that human contact, but there's also something to be said about having that contact being recorded, especially if it goes awry. And oftentimes, and I listened to the show when Delegate Conaway was on, and one of the questions that came up was, would police be able to disable those cameras? And then what happens? Because mm-hmm. what we also see historically is that even though there's dashboard cameras on police cars, oftentimes, oh, guess what? Today, the camera wasn't working, so we don't know what happened in that mm-hmm. instance. So there is something to be said about having that that interpersonal action being taped. But as far as, you know, the overhead and pervasive cameras everywhere, that could be challenging, but some people like it. Yeah. Some people feel more secure.
There's an argument to be had that what Dave was making, I think, that retreat policemen on foot out of the patrol cars, police on bicycles, policemen actually inundating neighborhoods by walking, understanding and living with people and talking to them and sitting on people's stoops, mm-hmm. will go a lot farther in solving the crimes that people face and deterring crime than having drones flying overhead, taking pictures of everything people do in the city.
I think that works better in Baltimore. Just knowing the city and the communities and the way that people interact, the personal touch of walking the beat, and I think police will tell you this too. You know, you get to know people. You get to talk to people. They talk to you. So it's something to be... We'll be debating this drones for a while.
Yeah, I'm going to learn more about these drones, and I'm curious also. The question I asked the other day was just how much money does the city spend in our police budget on military equipment?
Mm-hmm. I know they'll say, well, a lot of it we got, you know, donated, you
grants,
know, from, you know,
federal,
from the federal government. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're right, in terms of, you know, on the ground, you get better information, you get more trust between the police and
right
the community.
Away.
And that's
right.
what the really important thing that's lacking in so many instances.
Mm-hmm.
So 410-319-8888 as we wind down this hour here on the Mark Steiner Show and our local roundtable. There are many things to cover. We're covering a great deal more in the coming weeks. We're going to be bringing you conversations here with people running for office. We didn't talk about the state's attorney's race. We'll do that maybe later in the week. We're going to talk about what happened there. And the anointed one now, and Ms. Mosby, is going into that office. 410-319-8888. Audrey, you're on the air. Audrey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. You have the final thought of the day. What is that?
I think the casinos will be a plus. Hi, how are you doing?
Good. We only have about a minute and a half left, so what's your thought?
My thought is that the casinos will help one way, but it's going to be a detriment to some because the money that's made doesn't always come back to the city for the schools like they say it will. You know, the lottery started out that way. They wanted to add more games, we'll do more for school, and it seems like they've done less for school. I just hope that they'd be someone that can help them to enforce what they say they're going to do, and that's helped make the schools in Baltimore better for all kids.
I think that the question of how and who decides how this money is being spent and where it's going is one of the most critical factors in all of this.
As they say, follow the money.
Follow the money, which is your job, Melody.
Yeah, I know.
As investigative
it's not
report.
So easy. Not but that's the key to a lot of these things. Just follow the money and find out and try to get answers if you can. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to get answers anymore.
Melody Simmons, over 35 years as an independent journalist, almost won that Pulitzer for investigative warning, investigative work here when she was with The Sun, writes for The Brew Now and other journals. Good to have you in the studio once
again. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Natasha Pratt-Harris has joined us once again. She's been absent for too long. She's back in the studio. Associate Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminal Justice Program Coordinator, Austin Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Morgan State University. Good to have you back in the studio.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Good to have you. Dr. John Bullock, Professor of Political Science at Towson University. Thanks for being here for the last couple of hours with
us. Hey, always great to be here.
And we're going out there with Love Train by the OJs. Walter Williams was born on this day in 1942. Love the OJs. There we are. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Henry. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Sienna Greaves. To hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, please go to steinershow.org. It's all right there. Or you can also download and podcast our shows on iTunes. And for Public Radio WEAA, 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.